I have provided on the system two core chapters. One is international finance, historical development and evolution, and the other one is on international finance markets. What essentially happens is this: we look at the historical origin, evolution and development of the markets in one, and then we're looking at the nature, operation, structure and the sub-markets in two. So what you'll see in chapter one, we're looking at the history of money and coinage, banking and credit, ancient period, Italian and Dutch banking. This was mainly to do with the great fairs, with town fairs, village fairs, town fairs, and then great fairs across Europe from around the 1200s, 1300s, 1400s, mainly in North Italy, where a lot of the early banking practices grow, a lot of the early international finance, the trade finance grows. Although banking itself actually goes way back to Egypt, well, even then actually goes back to ancient Mesopotamia. We had the Akkadians, the Assyrians, and the Babylonians. There was a famous family in Babylonia called the House of Egibi. That was 600 to 42 BC. There was 1,700 tablets, five generations of bankers, 600 BC. We also had international banking that actually began with the Knights Templar. So we had the Knights Templar were created by Hugh de Payne in 1119. Hugh de Payne actually married Catherine de Sinclair, who was Scottish noble family, so that the Knights Templars were always closely associated with Scotland, and in particular, Sinclair's the Sinclair Castle and Roslyn Chapel, which is just south of Edinburgh. The Knights Templar lasted for 188 years. They were actually set up to protect the roads to Jerusalem so that pilgrims could access Jerusalem and pray. However, what actually happened was they became a very powerful military force and then a merchant and banking and financial force. They actually developed international banking, the use of bank accounts, cross-border transfers, the use of being able to collect deposit funds from different repositories around Europe, including in Paris and in London. At the end of Fleet Street, I am a member of Inner Temple Fleet Street, where the Knights Templar used to be based. The Knights Templar lasted 188 years. They were the most successful property and financial developers at that time, that they caused a massive amount of attention by the kings and the queens, and in particular Philip the Simple in France. And it was for that reason that they were closed down on 13th of October 1307. And that's why we still talk about Black Friday. And the then leader was Jacques de Molay. And Jacques de Molay was burnt at the stake with two of his other colleagues, with a lot of the other knights having been tortured by the authorities at that time to try and locate where all of the funds, all of the treasure that they had amassed was. What we then have is modern banking, in terms of cross-border banking and trade finance, begins in Italy in the 1400s, mainly with the emergence of these great fairs, which will then expand across the rest of Europe. We develop, for example, bills of exchange. Bill of exchange becomes the most important payment instrument almost in history. A merchant doesn't have funds to pay another merchant, but he's owed money by a third merchant. So he tells the third merchant to pay the second merchant so that he can acquire the goods immediately from the second merchant. That's then documented in what looks like a simple banknote, but that note, that bill of exchange, can then be passed around a whole number of other merchants. These were initially used inside the fair. So you'd have a fair which might last 1 week, 1 month. You had them in places like Lyon and Antwerp, North Italy, and then moving up Bruges, Antwerp in Europe. The great fairs might last months. They might last 1, 2, 3 months. All the merchants from Europe would come together at the fair. The fair would establish its own legal system and its own banking and financial system and its own court system. This is where Lex Mercatoria comes from. So what would actually happen is at the fair, bankers would buy things using the credit that they were expected they were due from other merchants by having this evidence in the form of a bill of exchange that they would pass around the fair. At the end of the fair, after 3 months, the merchant at the beginning, who was asked to pay the first or second merchant, he would pay the last merchant in this chain. So one bill of exchange could go around hundreds of merchants and then be settled at the end of the fair. What would then happen is these bills of exchange were used outside the fare system. They were used all around the world. And the most important bill was the bill on London. And during the 1700s, 1800s, 1900s, the bill on London was the most important international payment instrument before we had electronic funds transfer. And what simply would happen is this: people would use bills of exchange all around the world. They would ship them to London, and you had two specialist bankers. You had a discount house and an acceptance house. The discount house would accept the bill and pay face value less interest due until the bill matured, and that was the discount. So the discount is the interest due on the residual value of the bill until payment. So the discount house pays face value less residual interest, which is the discount. What would then happen is, because the discount house has discounted the bill, you take it to an acceptance house, an acceptance house stamps it, and it's as good as cash. And these two processes, making it as good as cash with the acceptance house and then discounting the bill, meant that you could create, fund massive amounts of trade all around the world on this simple model. And the most important payment instrument was the bill on London, for that simple reason. That's partly why London emerges and stays the most important international financial centre for a long time, certainly until after the Second World War, because of the gold standard and because of the bill of exchange. So I deal with the historical development to all of this in the paper. We're then looking at the emergence of the euro-dollar market in the post-war period. Essentially, we're going to ship a large amount of dollar assets, dollar funds from the United States to London after the Second World War. By this point, the United Kingdom government authorities, we've exhausted all of our gold reserves, all of our foreign exchange reserves, bearing the cost of two world wars. Because of that, the dollar emerges as the most important currency after the Second World War. The United States is the most important economy after the Second World War, and therefore the centre of the international financial system shifts to dollars in dollar assets, but not to America itself. What happens is that London re-emerges as the offshore financial centre for dollar debt initially, and then all other forms of debt. And this is the beginning of the euro-dollar markets. We always had international finance. So you could have international finance raised in any country in the currency of that country. So Deutschmarks in Berlin, francs in Paris, lira in Rome. But what happens is, after the Second World War, we have the beginning of the euro-dollar markets. And what we're doing is this: we're issuing debt denominated in a currency outside the country of issuance. And that's the significance of this. So all of these dollar assets are brought over to London, and then we create this massive interbank market, a dollar interbank market, so all the banks can borrow and sell dollars between each other, completely outside the control of the American authorities in the United States. What then happened is this expands massively to cover all of the other main international currencies, so that any currency can be traded in London as a currency itself, but also you can buy and sell either in the form of a loan or through issuing bonds in the euro dollar markets, with the emergence of, as I said, those three key markets now. We have the interbank market, which is also called a placement or a taking market. We then have the syndicated loan market, and we have the Eurobond market. And in each of these cases, what we're doing is we're raising funds in an international currency other than the country of issuance. So London, despite the loss of its premier status, sterling collapses in value, dollar becomes the most important international currency in the world, but the euro-dollar markets move to London. And they've stayed in London ever since. 60-70% of the market, of the bond markets here, 65% of the national foreign currency markets here, 20-30% of the banking markets here. There has been some reallocation of staffing and management following the UK withdrawal from the European Union, but still London's remained the most important international financial centre, and it will simply find a new position going forward. It will find a new New fields, new areas, new specializations. We think it will particularly happen in the areas of financial technology, and then artificial intelligence and artificial financial intelligence. All of this could very much support London going forward. All of the advantages, all of the benefits that made London the international financial centre it was, will remain. Open political climate, political neutrality, adherence to the rule of law, very light, relaxed, regulatory system, but careful oversight by the Bank of England, a very strong, large, powerful professional class, all of the conditions you need to the major international financial centre are still here and they will always be here. The paper then goes on to look at the international capital markets. So this is basically switching from the euro loan market, which is a syndicated lending market. We can transfer, for example, a 20-year, 100 million loan from the loan market into the bond market. And the key point simply is this. Because of the additional liquidity, negotiability, transferability and negotiability of the bond, negotiability means you can acquire perfect title so long as you acquire the asset without any notice of any prior defect in title. That means you can usually almost always borrow at a finer coupon rate. So it's always cheaper to borrow in the bond markets than it is in the loan markets. But what then happens is the history of these markets, and I've summarised it on the table there, floating rate notes, FRNs, euro notes and note issuance facilities, NIFs, NIFs, euro commercial paper, ECP, medium-term notes, MTNs, and then multi-option facilities, MOFs, or multi-option funding facilities, MOFs. The history is shorter duration. Now, all that simply means is this. You go from a long 20-year bond down to a 5, 10, 15-year medium-term note, down to a 5-year note, maybe a 3, 1, 2, down to 1-year euro note. If you go less than 1 year, it becomes paper. So paper up to 1 year, notes generally 1 to 20, bonds 20 plus. Although you can have slightly shorter bonds. In law, the strict difference is that if it pays fixed interest, it's a bond. If it pays floating interest, it's a note. So I then summarise the early history of these floating rate notes. They all emerged following the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, beginning of the 1970s. So we see the FRNs, 1970s, 1980s. These note issuance facilities, the NIFs, what happens is this. The companies and the governments still need the same debt and they're still always going to need it. And if anything, they usually need more over time. So the fact that they repay the debt after, say, 5 years, they still simply need to reissue it. So whether you've got one program of 20-year bonds, if you have four programs of 5-year notes, all you're doing is repaying them and then reissuing it. In those cases, what we do is we have programs or issuance facilities we set up. Because what we don't want to do is this. We don't want to bring the same law team and investment banking team in each time. So we set the system up whereby the companies or the governments can issue the notes themselves. So after 5 years or 3 years or 2 years, they can just reissue the notes back into the market again. So we have these programs or issuance facilities that allow you to go back in and just reissue. Now those will either, and we'll see this later when we look at the language, be committed or uncommitted. What that means is if it's committed, an investment bank has to buy them or help you sell them on. If it's uncommitted, the company or the government takes the risk that the market may or may not buy them. And we'll come back to that. So now historically, I've got MTNs at point number four. The simple point was this. We went from the long bonds to the short euro notes and then back up to the medium-term notes. It was just a historical accident, largely because it followed the US domestic market. So we went from long to short and then back up to mediums. And then multi-option facilities. When you're advising a bank or a banker, investment banker is advising a government or a company about the most appropriate facility, generally, the advice will be if you have good credit standing, you will use the capital markets because you can get finer coupon rates. You can borrow more, cheaper in the capital markets. However, you've then got all these different options. So what happens with a MOF, a multi-option facility, you actually provide for all that as part of one single facility. So it's a combination of different options. So usually a MOF will include an MTN, a medium-term note. It may also have bankers' acceptances. Bankers' acceptances, as we've mentioned already, that's where a company issues a bill of exchange and the bank's already accepted it. It's stamped it, it's signed it. Because a bank stamps and signs your bill, it becomes as good as cash. So that's a very valuable money market instrument, an MMI, a mini, or a MMI. We can also have swing line facilities. A swing line is when you're moving from one facility to another and you want temporary borrowing. You may also have a swap to exchange obligations, or to exchange currencies, or to exchange almost anything now. You can have different facilities as part of the MOF. So the MOF includes a number of different options to give the borrower, the company, or the government as much flexibility as possible. So we'll just see this. We go from long bonds, and the first bond was the Euro Autostrade deal. That was S.J. Warburg, 1963. That was the Italian government borrowing to pay for all of the motorway system in North Italy. That was the first bond, 1963. So what we then see in the 70s is the development of these separate FRN, NIF, ECP, MTN, and MOF programs. And it's all in the paper. We've then got the derivatives markets. The derivatives emerge at the beginning of the 1970s simply because of the additional new foreign currency instability and interest rate instability and just wider market instability. Borrowers, asset holders, they needed risk protection. And what did the banks do? The banks provided that in the form of the development of the financial derivatives market. A lot of this is demand driven. Massive new levels of instability. So the bankers, the financiers, they create a whole new series of asset classes to help manage this. We have futures, options and swaps, then credit derivatives, and then hybrids. A future is simply an obligation to buy or sell at a future fixed time, price, and amount. Obligation, buy or sell at a future fixed price, time, and amount. An option is the right to buy or sell at a future fixed time, price, and amount. And a swap is simply an exchange of obligations. I will pay dollars, you pay yen, I pay French franc, I pay euros, you pay renminbi. Or it could be interest rates. Very often it's cheap to borrow fixed in one financial centre and floating in another, so you can swap the interest rates. You can borrow in one and set that off against another. And then all sorts of things now we can exchange as well, whether it's commodities or risks, all sorts of things. Derivatives can now be used to manage any form of risk or exposure, as well as independent investment classes in their own rights. So almost every type of derivative, although it was initially designed to manage risk or loss, which is 0.5 on my functional ladder, in the modern world, these all can be used as independent investment assets in their own terms and their own rights. Then we have asset-backed finance and securitization. This is where we transfer assets from the banking markets to the securities markets using an intermediate special purpose vehicle. We can have any pool of credit assets, whether it's residential mortgages, corporate real estate interests, student loans, car loans, finance, any type of retail finance, any type of credit exposure, so long as it's governed by identical terms and conditions. Each one of these assets by itself is worth very, very little, mainly because an acquirer would have to undertake an independent credit assessment, and that costs money, so they will insist on a large discount. And if you have a very large discount, we call that a fire sale. But we don't want to fire sale or discount these assets. But what we can do is this. So long as they're all governed by identical legal terms and conditions, we can group all the assets together into a pool. Everything governed by the same identical legal terms and conditions can be pooled. And then that asset pool becomes very valuable. And how do we realize its current value today? How do we monetize that? If that's a pool of 40-year mortgages, it's going to take 40 years to realise that. But how can we monetize that today? We sell the pool to an SPV. The SPV pays for it by issuing new notes, usually medium-term notes, into the market, and that pays for the purchase of the pool. The SPV then holds the pool and realises its value long-term, but the originating bank that sold the assets, it sold 20, 10, 40-year assets, but it's realised the value today. Very clever. Now, this is actually what created this massive global wall of liquidity just before the global financial crisis. It wasn't simple securitisation. It was secondary securitisation or re-securitisation, because what we can do is this. We can take all of these notes that have been created and we can securitise those. And that creates a collateralised debt obligation, a CDO. We can take 200, 250, 300 securitisations. We re-securitise them to another SPV. That's a CDO. We can then do that again and create a CDO squared and a CDO cubed. 35 CDOs becomes a squared. 5 CDO squares becomes a cubed. We can do this multiple levels with higher level SPVs each time. That's what created this massive global wall of liquidity before the global financial crisis. And that's what collapsed during the global financial crisis and was then reinflated by quantitative easing subsequently. So I deal with all of that in the paper as well. I then look at structured finance in further detail. So you'll see CLOs, CLN, CDOs. Everything's in the chapter. The second chapter then re-examines this, but this time it's looking at it from a market perspective. It's looking at the structure and operation of the markets themselves and the sub-markets. So one is principally historical, and the other basically reviews all of this in terms of the current operation and development of each of these markets. You can see all of that against the paper that I provided separately. This is basically chapter two. That division there is dealt with in chapter two. I go through and explain each all of the key markets there in further detail in the paper. All of this is then dealt with in those two chapters, one and two. You have the separate introductory paper, which provides the background to the international financial system, including, for example, the nature of the early development of the gold standards, then all the crises, Bretton Woods system. All of that's in the introductory paper, which also deals with all of the core legal issues and the various particular sub-markets that we'll come on to look at in further detail in each case. Everything is provided on the online system.